This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines from trade and transit to environment and media. Iran and Turkmenistan sign a number of deals to revamp bilateral cooperation. The first UK flight carrying asylum seekers to Rwanda is grounded thanks to last-minute ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. And also, Russia tells Ukrainian forces hold up at a chemical plant in Severodonetsk. They have until Wednesday morning to lay down their arms. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran and Turkmenistan have signed over a dozen cooperation documents in different fields to further expand their relations. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his Turkmen counterpart, Serdar Berdi Muhammadov, oversaw the signing ceremony in Tehran. After the ceremony, Raisi said Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy vast capacity to boost their ties. He also pointed to Iran's determination to sign long-term strategic agreements with its neighbor. Raisi said the Tehran-Ashgabat cooperation would definitely lead to further regional development. The Iranian president touched also on regional problems and stressed that they should be resolved by regional governments. He underlined that foreign presence will not bring security and stability to the region. The Turkmen president, for his part, called for close cooperation with Tehran on issues such as the Caspian Sea legal regime. He also called for enhancing relations with Iran in international bodies. Well, for further insight on that story, we're now joined by Central Asia Caucasus analyst, Mr. Omid Rahimi, who's joining us from Gorgon. Mr. Rahimi, welcome to the program. We know that Iran and Turkmenistan share historical bonds. What is the significance of this visit, specifically at this point in time?
In the name of God, there's an important point that this is the second official visit by the President of Turkmenistan to Iran. And another important point is that Turkmenistan is currently experiencing a new situation after the corona pandemic, and after the coming to power of the 13th administration led by President Raisi, it has attached importance to such relations. And in the course of the Economic Cooperation Organization meeting, he also met with the President of Turkmenistan earlier in time. And I can also refer to the differences regarding the purchase of Turkmenistan gas by Iran. So after the talks and based on new agreements, that issue has been resolved. Also, I can refer to commercial exchanges in the past 1 year. There has been tangible growth in the volume of trade exchanges. So there has been 84% growth. There was an 84% growth in 2021. In the meantime, the Central Asian states in the new era, particularly after the start of the war in Ukraine, they have come across new regional and global developments, and that has actually led to diversification of their trade partners alongside Russia. And this is an opportunity that can be, that they can benefit from.
Mr. Rahimi, talk to us about the level of trade exchanges and how the cooperation deals that the two countries have signed will bring these two neighbors closer together economically, and also what other fields will these deals be covering?
As you said, there has been a growth, 84% growth in the volume of trade exchanges in 2021. This is the outcome of trade exchanges by the two countries in different areas. Prior to this, the trade volume had hit a figure of $2 billion, so there are ample capacities for the growth of such exchanges. I can refer to the issue of gas. Iran, in order to meet its gas demands in northeastern part of the country, it has to import gas from Turkmenistan. The first gas export pipeline outside Central Asia was related to Iran in the 1990s, and it was at the time when Mr. Rafsanjani was the president, and there was another pipeline in 1388 Iranian calendar. It was laid in Khan, Iran, and it was used for transfer of gas to Iran. Turkmenistan, as a landlocked state, has certain limitations for the export of its gas. The recent agreements between Iran and Turkmenistan and the Republic of Azerbaijan have paved the way for other types of cooperation in this said area. That is known as the gas swap. During the visit by our oil minister to Baku, there was an agreement for doubling the volume of that gas swap. That is also an important area, and Iran can turn into a hub for the export of Turkmenistan's gas to other states. So speaking of engineering services, there are ample capacities with respect to both countries' exchanges. Iran has implemented very good projects in Turkmenistan. There were agreements signed by the two countries in the past. Also, in the food industry, the two countries had very good cooperation, and foodstuffs were exported from Iran to Turkmenistan, and such opportunities do still exist. In the meantime, I can refer to Iran's textile industry. It can make use of cotton from Turkmenistan, use it in its textile industry, and this can be quite beneficial, and this can bring about a bilateral framework actually meeting both countries' interests. I can also refer to the area of transit. And Iran can act as a bridge for connecting Central Asia to the high seas, and also Eurasia and parts of China. So both countries had good agreements in the field of transit, and there was the Ashgabat Agreement, and they were signed before, and both countries can cooperate in this within the framework of such agreements. There is also the North-South International Corridor project that is also of importance, and that can also expand cooperation with India and China as well. And the last point is that there are good opportunities for cooperation by Iran and Turkmenistan in Afghanistan, and both countries attach importance to Afghanistan, particularly with respect to Afghanistan's economic development. That can also pave the way for further cooperation by the two countries.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Omid Rahimi, joining us from Gorgon. Elsewhere, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for politicizing Iran's nuclear program under Israel's pressure, despite extensive cooperation from Tehran.
The IAEA has time and again inspected Iranian nuclear sites and found no diversion in the country's nuclear program. I hope the agency is freed from the grip of the Zionist regime and stops politically motivated measures to prevent the reputation and credibility of the IAEA and its director general from being harmed further.
Mohammad Islami was speaking a week after the IAEA Board of Governors adopted a resolution accusing Iran of failing to fully cooperate with the agency. Islami rejected that, saying the allegation had been orchestrated by Israel to impede Iran's nuclear progress. He said Iran provided the agency with clarifications regarding its nuclear activities as part of trust-building measures. The IAEA resolution was submitted by the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and France. Iran's foreign minister has said the U.S. pushed for the resolution to gain more concessions in talks over the 2015 deal.
Despite continued indirect messages between Tehran and Washington, as well as progress made in the talks, the U.S. unexpectedly submitted a resolution at the IAEA to put political pressure on the Islamic Republic and to gain more concessions in the indirect negotiations. Although the U.S. had informed Iran that the resolution was empty of content, the U.S. itself prompted Tehran to issue a stern warning to Washington over such measure. Iran put forward a new political package, a new initiative to the negotiating table. The U.S. had welcomed the initiative, but at the same time pushed for the resolution.
Amir Abdullahian said that Iran, in reaction to the U.S. move, increased its nuclear activities at some sites. He added the U.N. nuclear watchdog has been informed about these activities. The top diplomat underlined, however, that despite the recent resolution, Tehran will continue the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal until a good, strong, and lasting accord is reached. U.S. Advisor for Energy Security Amos Hochstein has met Lebanese officials in Beirut. The Lebanese official said their country has the right to defend its natural resources in a maritime dispute with Israel. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Senior U.S. Advisor for Energy Security Amos Hochstein met high-ranking Lebanese officials in Beirut. During the talks, Lebanese officials said conditions for talks are confidential, but stressed their main demand is Lebanon maintain its right to defend its natural resources.
For the Lebanese government, the point 29 will be considered as a negotiation point, and the 23 point will be considered as the realistic point that will draw the Lebanese borders over the sea.
The conflict over petrol and gas fields began more than 10 years ago when the U.S. proposed the so-called Hof Line, which is lower than Line 23, stripping Lebanon of some 860 square kilometers. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister Mikati, and Speaker Nabi Hibiri all stressed a unified stance for Lebanon that the country will not concede its right to begin drilling offshore.
because of the American embargo over on Lebanon, we could not drill for our rights to extract our gas and oil because we have to be delayed until the Israeli and the Zionist entity to extract their wealth before us. Therefore, the American negotiator is taken aside, and it's very obvious that they are not negotiating for our benefit, but for the benefit of our enemy.
A recent move by Israel to attempt drilling in the Karish field, which falls within Line 29, has led to opposition from Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has also warned the floating petrol company Energean against drilling in that area as long as it is disputed, and also cautioned that Israeli drilling could reach depths closer to potentially gas-rich Lebanese fields. Lebanon's main dilemma now is that time is running out and its natural resources could be looted at any time. Analysts believe the officials need to firstly demand that the U.S. lift its undeclared blockade and allow contracted companies to implement their obligations and drill in purely Lebanese fields. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Britain's first flight to take asylum seekers to Rwanda is canceled after the European Human Rights Court issued last-minute injunctions to stop the deportation of the handful of the migrants on board. Shortly before the plane was due to leave, the European Court of Human Rights moved to prevent their deportation. The British government now says it won't be deterred and it will prepare for the next flight. Now, the plan to send some migrants to the East African country has been criticized by some rights groups and international bodies. The United Nations refugee chief has called it catastrophic. The government has been forced to fight a series of legal challenges in London courts to stop it from going ahead. Britain says the plan will stem the flow of dangerous sea trips to the country. And Iran joins the growing crowd of critics of Britain's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Tehran says the plan is a historic disgrace for London and all those who try to mask their imperialistic record. Iran's foreign ministry said the forced transfer of asylum seekers to third countries is a clear violation of their rights. Said Khatibzadeh said the silence of countries who proclaim to be the defenders of human rights on this issue is also a shame. The ministry said the plan sets a dangerous precedent that threatens to destroy the international regime for the protection of asylum seekers. Iranian spokesman said the rights of these asylum seekers, who also include some Iranians, must be observed. Russia calls Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise, warning that such a move could escalate and destabilize the situation further. Russia's envoy to Syria made the remarks as the Kazakh capital is holding a new round of talks in the Astana format aimed at ending the Syria conflict. Alexander Lavrentiev also described relentless Israeli strikes on Syrian territories as unacceptable, saying the issue needs to be focused on the guarantor states of the Astana process for a settlement in Syria. Namely, Iran, Russia, and Turkey are in attendance in Nur Sultan. There are also the representatives of the Syrian government and opposition, as well as the UN. Ankara says it plans to launch a military operation to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Damascus has strongly condemned the plan, saying it's part of Ankara's efforts to push for a demographic change in the area. Russia says it will open a humanitarian corridor to allow civilians encircled in a chemical plant in the eastern city of Severodonetsk to leave the area. The Russian Defense Ministry said the civilians will be evacuated to the Luhansk region, which is controlled by pro-Russia forces. The Russian military has called on Ukrainian troops in Severodonetsk to lay down arms and stop their, quote, senseless resistance by early Wednesday. Local Ukrainian officials say some 500 people have been seeking shelter in the chemical plant and are under heavy fire. The developments came after Russia destroyed all three bridges which connect Severodonetsk to the nearby city of Lysychansk. Russian forces are currently controlling 70% to 80% of Severodonetsk. The fall of the city would pave the way for Moscow to fully control the mainly Russian-speaking Donbass region. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
In the limelight.
What happened on and around January 6th was a conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election and to keep Trump in office as an illegitimate pretender to power, says John Nicholas, Washington correspondent, in an article published under the heading Call January 6th What It Was, an explicit attempt to stage a coup. Stay tuned for more.
Representative Mark Pocan recognized the significance of the language employed during last week's extraordinary primetime hearing of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the United States Capitol, and he embraced it. "This was not a spontaneous mob attack on the U.S. Capitol," said the Democratic representative from South Central Wisconsin's 2nd District, adding, "It was an explicit attempt to stage a coup and override a free and fair election." Exactly. For too long, pundits and political leaders adopted cautious language in describing the deadly January 6, 2021 assault on the Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump. That was a mistake that January 6 committee chair Benny Thompson, D. Mississippi, rectified recently. What happened on and around January 6 was a conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election and to keep Trump in office as an illegitimate pretender to power. Donald Trump was at the center of that conspiracy, explained Thompson, who then said what every member of Congress should have said on the day that Trump called upon his supporters to fight like hell to position him not as an elected president, but as an authoritarian strongman who had seized power. Any legal jargon you hear about seditious conspiracy, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States boils down to this. January 6 was the culmination of an attempt coup. A brazen attempt, as one writer put it shortly after January 6, to overthrow the government. The violence was no accident. It represented Trump's last stand, most desperate chance to hold the transfer of power, unquote. With those words, Thompson brought clarity to a conversation. What happened on January 6 was always an attempt coup. Now, finally, the chairman of the congressional committee that has been charged with getting to the bottom of a conspiracy has labeled it as such. This matters because until the investigators get the language right, America cannot have an honest discussion of what happened on the day that supporters of a man who had lost the 2020 election by 7 million votes stormed the U.S. Capitol in a violent effort to prevent the certification of the Electoral College votes that were to confirm that defeat. Ruth Ben Gayot, the scholar of fascism and authoritarian leaders who teaches history at New York University, immediately recognized the significance of the committee chair's statement. "Chairman Thompson for calling it a coup, that's great," she said. "Some still call it a riot, which does not capture the larger political design of overturning our democracy," she added. Trump's defenders mocked the turn of phrase and the hearings in general, but there was no denying the accuracy of the term that Thompson employed. Polity, Fact, an independent fact-checking operation run by the Poynter Institute, noted Thompson's coup reference and pointed out that the coup data project at the University of Illinois Klein Center for Advanced Social Research, which monitors coups around the world, had determined that the storming of the Capitol was an attempt coup d'état, an organized, illegal attempt to intervene in the presidential transition by displacing the power of Congress to certify the election. It was a coup attempt. Referring to it as such opens a new chapter in the discussion of the high crimes that Donald Trump and his allies committed on January 6, 2021.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The British royal family, an institution instantaneously recognizable throughout the world. Positioning itself as both the face and heart of Britain, the monarchy purports to perform a dual role. Promote British interests on the global stage, and at the same time sustain and justify its own institutional relevance. The royal family sets out to perform these apparently complementary roles by projecting a carefully crafted and jealously guarded image of propriety, diligence, and unflinching pursuit of duty. To that end, the British monarchy goes to extraordinary lengths to discourage, distract, and disrupt any real scrutiny of its true role and performance. But keeping up appearances is not always an easy task. The recent controversy surrounding the estrangement of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle is just the latest of a long line of scandals engulfing the royal family in the past three decades. Much to the Queen's dismay, the so-called Harry and Meghan saga has depicted the royal family in a poor light. The most serious charge relating to allegations of racism, initially directed at Meghan Markle, whose mother is African-American, and then more ominously towards her baby. As Meghan Markle recounted to Oprah Winfrey in the now famous interview in March 2021, an anonymous senior member of the royal family was concerned how brown her baby was going to be. There was widespread speculation that the anonymous racist at the top of the royal family was none other than the new deceased Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth for 74 years. The notorious escapades of Princess Diana, wherein the estranged wife of Prince Charles engaged in multiple extramarital affairs, was arguably the first time in modern times that the carefully managed moral reputation of the British royal family was shattered in front of a global audience. Similar to Meghan Markle, the late Princess Diana informed the world of her pain and anguish through a hard-hitting interview with BBC Panorama in November 1995. The description that Diana provided of the royal family nearly three decades ago is eerily similar to its recent depiction by Meghan Markle. But Both accounts present the British monarchy as a cold, distant, and unfeeling organization, which not only demands total obedience from its members, but by extension, it goes to extreme lengths to discredit those who are perceived to have broken the rules. Strategic heavy lift capability. Both Diana and Meghan are perceived to have broken the rules, and very quickly the two women were ostracized and cast as outsiders. Diana would ultimately pay with her life for daring to criticize and expose royals. And as for Meghan Markle, it remains to be seen what fate awaits her. For if Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire father of Princess Diana's late lover, Dodi Fayed, is to be believed, Princess Diana, alongside her lover Dodi, was murdered by the British Secret Service MI6 on the instructions of the monarchy. The allegations could be dismissed as a conspiracy theory, was the only one making them, but he is not. Even former MI6 officers have made the same allegations, and in the process, supplying credible details to support their incendiary claims. It is now widely suspected that Henry Paul, the deputy head of secretary at Ritz Hotel in Paris, who was driving Diana and her lover Dodi on that fateful late August night, was a long-standing MI6 agent. If indeed the Queen had given a nod and a wink to her Secret Service to deal decisively with the increasingly troublesome Diana, then there was a much bigger message conveyed by that suspected murder. You cross the British monarchy at your own peril.
Your Majesty's guard is ready to march off, ma'am.
To gauge the extent the Queen will go to protect her interests, the best place to start is the great name change of 1917, which enabled the British monarchy to conceal its German roots. By all credible accounts, the great majority of the British people are unaware of the distant roots of the monarchy. Since the accession of Queen Elizabeth II to the throne in 1952, the British establishment has tried hard to depict the monarchy as a quintessentially British institution. However, the reality is very different. The name change from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor was effected by King George V at the height of World War I, at a time when the British public were understandably alienated by German names. From this cynical name change, it can be deducted that there is nothing uniquely British about the royal family. Therefore, Tony Blair's assertion that the Queen and her entourage represent continuity in British public life is yet another cynical deception perpetrated against the British people. The Queen may project an image of quintessential Britishness, but it is doubtful that deep down she still doesn't feel a fondness for Germany, not necessarily contemporary liberal Germany, but the Germany of old, specifically the Teutonic way of life of the 19th century. Let's not forget that the longest reigning British monarch, Queen Victoria, who ruled for nearly 64 years, died in the arms of a German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Who, astonishingly enough, was her grandson on the Isle of Wight in 1901.
As a child, I never imagined that one day a man would walk on the moon.
The royal family reportedly continues to celebrate Christmas the German way by opening presents after afternoon tea on Christmas Eve, which falls on December 24th. By contrast, the British people open presents on Christmas morning, December 25th, typically before breakfast. Although these quirks might be dismissed on the grounds of sentimentalism and nostalgia, but the story gets much more sinister. Britain's shortest reigning monarch, Edward VIII, whose 11th month reign in 1936 coincided with the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany, is a case in point. Edward was well known for his pro-German political sympathies. Every drop of blood in my veins is German. Edward VIII is reported to have boasted to pro-German activist Diana Mitford, arguably the most accomplished of the notorious Mitford sisters and the then wife of British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley. Germany's ambassador to the court of St. James's, the prominent Nazi Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was German foreign minister throughout World War II, even called Edward V half-German on account of the king's effusive pro-German sympathies, if not his mastery of the German language and cultural mores. Indeed, Edward VIII was no ordinary appeaser, insofar as he actively supported the German cause in the 1930s. His support for Nazi Germany started very early, no later than the foundation of the Nazi regime in 1933, when as Prince Edward he encouraged the young princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, to give Nazi salutes while on a visit to Germany. It is equally noteworthy that, like his brother before him, King George VI was an admirer of Hitler and the Nazis, and an active supporter of the policy of appeasement, which historians blame for the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939. It has often been said that had Edward VIII been an ordinary citizen, he would most likely have been charged with his treason and swiftly executed following the conclusion of World War II in Europe in May 1945. Another element of Britishness is, without doubt, the Treason Act of 1351, one of the oldest pieces of legislation still on the statute books. At the same time, this ancient law is emblematic of the royal family's disregard, if not contempt, for the body of ancient English laws which it claims to uphold. One quirk of this ancient law is that it constitutes high treason to violate the wife of the king's eldest son, or in contemporary terms, the queen's son, which in this case happens to be Prince Charles. Based on this law, multiple prosecutions could have been launched against the various men, notably Army Major James Hewitt, who entered into consensual romantic and sexual liaisons with the late Princess Diana, the wife to heir apparent to the throne, Prince Charles. Despite her widespread popular appeal, Princess Diana was known to be promiscuous and had affairs with multiple men, including James Gilby, the heir to a large gin fortune, Etonian art dealer Oliver Hoare, rugby player Will Carling, the Pakistani heart and lung surgeon Hasnat Khan. There were even rumours she had an affair with John Kennedy Jr., the late son of John F. Kennedy. Incidentally, until 1814, the penalty for high treason was death by hanging, drawing and quartering, thereafter reduced to death by hanging. Ignoring the Treason Act indicates that the British monarchy is more than willing and able to engage in legal manoeuvrings, even to the extent of seriously compromising the rich tapestry of ancient and modern laws and norms which underpin the UK's unwritten constitution in order to stay afloat. The Princess Diana saga, which only concluded with her untimely death in 1997, is just one example amongst many. Prince Andrew is yet another and much more contemporaneous example. The errant prince is wanted in the US for questioning in relation to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which saw multiple underage girls abused by the deceased American financier. Prince Andrew, or until very recently the Duke of York to give him his formal royal title, was a close confidant of the American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who chose to commit suicide in a lonely prison cell instead of facing the music for his shocking crimes. The Duke of York abused his royal privilege for more than 2 years to avoid accountability in a formal setting, and all the while the Queen said nothing about the whole sordid affair, before she finally caved in to public pressure and stripped her son of all titles and charities. But then again, Prince Andrew has form when it comes to corruption and scandal. Dubbed Air Miles Andy on account of his extravagant travelling arrangements, it is reported that in 2003 alone, he racked up £325,000 flying around the world, including using a helicopter to fly to Oxford and misusing RAF planes to fly to Scotland to play golf. To make matters worse, his former wife, the scandal-prone Sarah Ferguson, caused deep embarrassment to the Queen when she was exposed by a News of the World sting operation in 2010, in which she promised to arrange access to Prince Andrew, who was then the UK's special trade envoy, in exchange for £500,000 in cash. If the royal family has struggled with issues of nationality and political allegiance, it could be said they have an easier relationship with religion and religious identity. Easier in the sense that the Act of Settlement 1701, whose cardinal aim was to ensure a Protestant succession to the English throne, places a prohibition on Catholics ascending to the crown as kings or queens. Astonishingly, this act is still religiously adhered to, and the British monarch is presented as defender of the faith, as in Protestantism. But the offence and discrimination this act inflicts is no longer limited to Roman Catholics, as the demographic and cultural diversity of Britain has hugely expanded since the early 1950s. Modern Britain is home to millions of people of non-Christian backgrounds, notably Muslims and Hindus. Since the early 1980s, the British government, in tandem with large business organisations and civil society writ large, has gone out of its way to place diversity at the pivot of its domestic policies. This attitude has given rise to an idiosyncratic British concept of multiculturalism, which purports to promote equality of opportunity amongst the UK's diverse demographic groups. But is the Queen's status of defender of the faith consistent with this policy? More broadly, the religious issue, although highly symbolic, is just one example among many where the Queen is seriously out of step with developments in British society. To properly integrate this disparity in world values in British society, the best place to start is the political realm. The UK likes to project itself as the world's oldest democracy, taking special pride in its parliamentary roots.
Hundreds of respondents took part in the Stoke-on-Trent.
Supporters of the British establishment never tire of reminding the world that their core parliament, the House of Commons, is the oldest such institution in the world. This is a myth, of course, as there are many ancient parliaments out there, such as the Swedish Parliament, or the Riksdag, some of which predate the House of Commons by decades and even centuries. Pedantic disputes aside, the modern House of Commons is generally recognised as a democratic institution, as demonstrated by the rigorous selection and election processes, which take place before someone from whichever political party takes up his or her place in Parliament. And yet these very same people have to not only swear an oath of allegiance to an unelected monarch, but worse still, throughout their tenure, they are forced to demonstrate defence to the royal family, often against their own best judgment. At least for the past 120 years, there have been professed Republicans who are against the monarchy establishment in the House of Commons and, lesser still, in the House of Lords. There are not many of them, but the fact they are there and are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen introduces a degree of hypocrisy into the British political process.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors according to law.
Worse still, the fact that MPs are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen is the strongest indicator that all legal and constitutional means for removing the Queen and the royal family have been closed off. Short of a revolution, the British people simply cannot overthrow their unelected rulers. The Queen, of course, does not reciprocate in kind, insofar as she does not swear an oath to uphold parliamentary democracy, let alone serving the people. But the real picture is much worse than that, inasmuch as every major British institution, from the military down to the prison system, is trapped in this unreciprocated oath of allegiance. On account of this comprehensive hegemony, how can stalwarts of the British establishment claim the Queen is bereft of political power and yet keep a straight face at the same time? At this juncture, it is necessary to gauge an accurate picture of the extent of the Queen's powers. Just how powerful is she, and to what extent can the monarchy affect the tide of British destiny? The simple answer, of course, is that the Queen and her heirs have tremendous powers, which affect the daily lives of Britons and, to a lesser extent, the citizens of those countries where the Queen is still nominally head of state, notably Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. In keeping with British tradition, where subtlety and discretion are prized characteristics, the monarchy exercises political power through ancient and seemingly innocuous-sounding institutions. One such institution is the Privy Council, officially a body comprised of senior politicians whose job is to advise the Queen on the exercise of the royal prerogative. For one thing, the Privy Council remains a secretive arm of the state, with a set of traditions and rituals that come close to Masonic theatrics. And at the centre of its official business is the Queen herself, who is physically present every time the Council meets to utter the words approved or referred in order to direct or influence policy proposals. In short, the Privy Council constitutes the principal vehicle by which the royal prerogative is enforced. In the words of the former Liberal Democrat MP turned establishment critic, Norman Baker, the Privy Council is effectively a one-person law-making, decision-taking machine. The royal prerogative, whose spirit and functions are embodied in the Privy Council, has multiple layers, with each layer in turn producing multiple, if not countless, powers and privileges. For instance, the prerogative of perfection is a function which confers personal immunity on the sovereign from ever being sued in the courts. The Queen is quite literally above the law. If the Privy Council represents the hard edge of the Queen's far-reaching powers, then the honours system constitutes the soft core of her barely concealed, all-encompassing influence. Going back all the way to 1348, with the establishment of the Order of Chivalry against the backdrop of the Black Death Plague, Britain's honours system enables the Queen to maintain the country's social and economic hierarchy. By doling out honours, indirectly by way of the government, the Queen confers favours and recognition to those whom she approves of. Officially designed to distinguish between different degrees of achievement and service, the honours system actually performs the opposite by conferring recognition on those the establishment, and by extension the Queen, seeks to promote and elevate. But the honours system, like every feature of British public life, is vulnerable to deep corruption. In the Cash for Honours scandal of 2006 to 2007, for instance, honours and peerages for the House of Lords were offered to individuals who had made large financial donations to the then-ruling Labour Party. The Queen clearly knew about the corruption, but for reasons of political expediency, or some other consideration, she chose to turn a blind eye to it. In one of the latest controversial examples, the Queen directly bestowed knighthood to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, regarded by many as a war criminal for his role in waging the 2003 Iraq War. The story of the real royals does not stop there.
In the limelight.
The deceit and lies and cover-ups of the worst moments in post-9/11 history have created an endless stage of hypocrisy for all the world to see, says Elise Swain, author, in an article published under the heading "The Truth Never Mattered at Guantanamo." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Army Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman was on guard duty at Guantanamo Bay in a tower with the entire prison complex sprawled out beneath him when he saw a white prison transport van drive from Alpha Block toward the prison entrance gate. It was the evening of June 9, 2006. Once the van passed through the gate, it made an unusual left turn. The only possible destination for detainees in that direction was a CIA black site, some of the guards refer to as Camp No, because officially it did not exist. As the sun was setting, after the detainees had their evening meal, Hickman observed the van driving twice more toward the facility. Hours later, three detainees were declared dead. The official explanation that the government has maintained for 16 years this week is an unbelievable version of events that has been ripped apart in later reporting. The Navy says the men killed themselves by hanging in separate, non-adjoining cells in the same way, at the same time, under video surveillance, with no guards noticing and no prisoners calling for the guards to intervene. They tell us that each of the men had bound their wrists and ankles with fabric and shoved fabric down their own throats, and then ask us to believe that they hung themselves. Despite explosive reporting by Scott Horton for Harper's Magazine, in which multiple sources, including Hickman, refuted the official narrative and gave evidence that a cover-up had taken place, no independent official investigation of the incident was ordered. The Department of Justice, asked to look into the Navy's unbelievable explanation of events, eventually reviewed the allegations of cover-up and found no evidence of wrongdoing. This disturbing episode quickly turned unspeakably dark. Independent autopsies ordered by the families of the dead were useless since the bodies, which showed signs of torture, had been sent home with missing parts. The men's throats, the larynx, the hyoid bone, and the thyroid cartilage had been removed. Even after this shocking finding, the door was closed. There would be no investigations. Hickman went on to publish a book titled Murder at Camp Delta. For the American public, the loss of three unknown terrorists to suicide at Guantanamo prison was a passing story, if it registered at all, in the endless news cycle of America's so-called war on terror. But for Mansour Adyafi, an innocent Yemeni man trapped in Guantanamo, it was night, everything changed. He knew the three men he told Intercept. They had protested together, gone on hunger strike together, put themselves through hell to demand basic rights and human decency. In his memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Adyafi lays out his own account of that summer night. Mere hours after the men died, a devastated Adyafi was interrogated and beaten over the incident. Former detainees Mohammed Salhi and Ahmed Erachidi said in an interview that their cells, even in solitary confinement, were searched that night. The dead men, Salah Ahmed Al-Salami, 37, Mani Shaman Otyabi, 30, and Yasser Talal Al-Zahrani, 22, all of whom had been held without charge, were attacked by the camp commander. They are smart, they are creative, they are committed, Rear Admiral Harry B. Harris Jr. said. I think they have no regard for life, neither ours nor their own. I believe this was not an act of desperation, but an act of asymmetrical warfare waged against us. Angry guards and interrogators, embarrassed by the event, embarked on a month-long crackdown. Nothing made sense, Adyafi writes, adding, none of the brothers had talked about suicide. None of us had. We had just survived the hunger strike together. Conditions at the camp had gotten better, and we were preparing to strike again for even more changes.